I'm going to go back and ask
right.
you about some material you covered. Can you talk a bit about what proportion male to female workers there were within your own shop? I guess Aristocratic, where you worked, and then within the chain?
I would say that they had some car hops. I couldn't give you the figures. Where there were car hops, they were always male. In our particular shop, we didn't have car hops, but we had a donut machine, and one of the men worked on the... There was actually the janitor and this young fellow were the only men that were involved in our shop. And there would probably be maybe 15 women. And that's, you know, there could have been more than that. I think it's always the problem that I found out when I worked in the union is to try and find how many people were on payroll. Because if you're going to apply for certification, usually there's a number of part-time employees you forget to count. And if they happen to work on the day that you're there, then they could work against your certification.
Right. Did the men and women receive pretty well equal wages, or were
yes, in actual fact, they did. There were more. There were times you might have a male cook. I think towards the time before I left, we did have a male cook at our shop. I don't remember at any time them ever having women car hops. It was always men car hops. I don't believe the cooks as males got more than the women did. Prior to the union coming in, we probably had more women managers. But this seemed to change after the first application, and we ended up with more male managers.
Did the union continue the policy of equal pay between men and women?
I don't think there was ever any question other than, you know, there might have car hops pay and waitresses pay, but the differential would be on the basis of the amount of tips that a person could accrue in a certain job.
When you finally got certified, did you get certification for the entire chain?
No. No, we got actually two single certifications. And arguments were presented similar like they did to the banks, but the Labor Relations Board at that day still ruled that no, it was all right for us to have a single certification. And this is the issue that went into court, as I understand it.
Once the two shops were certified, were you then able to go out and do more organizing of different aristocrats?
No, because it was still in court, and they left it until such time as the company capitulated, and when the company capitulated so they wouldn't have to pay all the extra costs, then they allowed us to sign up members in every shop. And it was done with their, you know, their blessing in effect. They had to do it in paper, but as I say, it was still difficult because it is so unusual for an employer to say that, and because the fight had gone on so long, and it was done at such a level away from the store that there was really nobody. Like, I didn't talk union in that period of time because I didn't know when the situation was going to change. So that really, to get a letter saying from management, yes, it's okay, you can join a union, it was quite a job trying to convince people that this was really for their own good, that, you know, they should be doing it.
So you then went out and signed up the whole chain.
Right. But we didn't apply for certification for some time later.
How was that done, the signing up process? Did you people go out to different shops? Did you hold meetings?
Okay, no. We worked on the basis that the union representatives went to the different shops and would talk to someone in the shop, such as myself, who might know enough and encouraged us to carry on. And the company did not take action against us at that time.
So it was almost like self-organization. Within each shop with the support of the union.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. When that first period of organizing was taking place and you had not yet been approached by the union, did you know what was happening?
No, I had no idea. They did it, as I say, using the night janitor who had the opportunity of seeing the people who worked nights at the last thing, the people who came on morning the first thing, because my dining room closed earlier than the counter, I was out of the shop before this talk ever began. And I really think they were afraid to approach me because they felt I might be the person who could have gone to management. Now, every time you organize, you're always faced with the fact that you think someone is going to go. In this particular case, nobody went. There were a couple of that they didn't ask at all because they knew that they would be, you know, would cause difficulties.
What kind of issues prompted people to organize?
The wage in itself, the sort of offers that would be given to people if you stay so long, the prospects that are there. And then once they started, they discovered that those prospects weren't there, that they could see, as I say, people who finally moved up to be a store manager or manageress, as the case may be, and mostly manageresses in those days, and be getting up to $28 a week, and then all of a sudden just be let go on some very flimsy excuse.
Right. Okay. What was the first contract? What kind of demands did it include? Do you remember any of that?
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know, I really couldn't bring them to mind now. I would suggest it would be something like the first year that maybe everybody was going to get $20 a week, which was certainly above the minimum wage, and that there was a cut back in days and hours of work. I think that was probably, I'm not sure whether it was the first year or the second year, that we got a 5-day week.
Did you establish a union shop?
Yes. This was one of the major things that came in. Even with that in the contract, it was very difficult because there was such a turnover of staff that to try and get people to know why they had to join the union, get them out to meetings, it wasn't an easy thing. You were actually reorganizing 3 and 4 times a year.
Was that constant? Was that a constant problem of that union?
Yes, in a place like a hamburger chain, yes, it was. There was a great turnover. In fact, I would say from my years with the union, it took quite a period of time before any of the establishments actually became more easily, that they settled down. The Georgia Hotel, for example, that was probably one of the first hotels where you began to have people that had a record of 5 and 10 years employment. And it was during the time that I worked for Local 28 that Margaret Burgoyne, who was the business agent when I first started to work with her, was removed from office for conduct unbecoming an official.
What happened?
Charges were laid against her by the executive board because she had appeared at places where negotiations were to take place under the influences of liquor. And she had appeared in establishments and had got intoxicated to the point that someone had to go down and get her out of the place. It was an unfortunate thing, a personal problem in her own life, and she was charged and hearings were held and she was removed from office. She had some very good points and some of the people recognized it. So she got application cards from another union and signed up a number of people in 3 hotels enough to apply for certification. So this caused a great deal of turmoil. And that also resulted in another court case that went on for a period of time, and it was with the merger of the CLC and
Trades and Labor Congress.
Right. It was at that time that a decision was arrived at that said that in effect the applications, and this was only known at the very top level, that they were not properly set up to have had members, and that the case ended there. But there was a matter of maybe a year and a half where things were in great turmoil. I can remember standing on a street corner with some of the men standing behind me and saying things like, you know, maybe we should push her out in front of that car. I don't think they intended to do it, but it certainly was a very uneasy feeling when, you know, something like this happens. That, again, was something that set the union back a long period of time.
Was she trying to raid established locals?
Yes. The Georgia Hotel, which had been under contract for many years with Local 28, and she had signed up a great number of people there, the Niagara Hotel, and I just can't remember what the other one was. But she actually had signed up sufficient people that they were asking for Local 28 to be decertified. Well, Marble Arch was the other one.
As the hotel component of the union grew, did that mean that the restaurant component had a different kind of relation to the union?
Well, the biggest amount, the largest numbers of restaurants that were under certification, with the exception of the Aristocratic, where, as I say, there was a great turnover of staff and there wasn't too much profit to be divided amongst people so that you could negotiate, or that you could show any strength. I don't think we could have ever got a strike vote out of those different chains, different establishments. And the restaurants themselves were usually certified for the front end. They were not certified for the kitchen. In Vancouver at that time, the kitchen staff was nearly 100% Chinese. And they worked things out amongst themselves where if they were away for a day, their cousin came in and worked, and they were no way were they interested in belonging to the union. So when you went to make application, the Labor Relations Board at that time said the unit must be the total unit, not the front end. Therefore, we had difficulty, and in fact, we found it nearly impossible to sign up the people, the Chinese people at that time who were in the kitchens. So we couldn't, if the applications we made for a certification were lost because the unit, the whole establishment, was not large enough. We had a minority of people. There could be many people working in the kitchen that you weren't aware of at all, and the front end just didn't cover it. So we actually couldn't seem to get certification there. We also found that if we were applying for a certification where the sister local 676, the bartenders, had the other part of the house, then we had the help of them in getting the other people organized. They worked to talk to the staff that was there. And a hotel that had in those days, at first it was only beer parlors, or as it became beer parlors or cocktail lounges. People who had those types of outlets were making more money than a restaurant who in those days was not allowed to serve mixed drinks.
Did you find that it was particularly difficult to organize in the restaurants because of the kind of close relationship between the supervisory personnel and the staff?
Okay, I'll give you an example on that. There was a restaurant in the CNR station that had 5 employees. I tried to organize it once. I couldn't do anything. 2 years later, 2 women came in and said, "We want to be organized." I told them of my past experience and said, "Look, I will give you the application cards. If you can get all those women signed up that you tell me about, I will be very happy to go out and speak to them, write their receipts, and make application." I did that. They had everybody signed up. There was a challenge, and we had to have a vote. On the day of the vote, one woman had quit, and they had hired another person. I suggested that probably it was going to be a very close vote. It was suggested to me that the woman who had quit would be entitled to vote. Remember, we didn't have very much money in those days. I'd been late getting there because streetcar was in held up. I phoned the woman and told her that if she would take a cab down, I would pay her cab fare there and back, because she just washed her hair and she had it in curlers. She came down and she voted, and when we counted up the vote, I got 1 vote. So there, I mean, obviously the pressure from the people that are there. I can remember another instance in a hotel where the same thing happened. They approached the union. I didn't happen to be the business agent that dealt with that, but I know they approached, said they wanted to join the union. They'd got these cards from somebody's husband. They paid their money. It was challenged. When it came to a vote, every one of them voted no, they didn't want to belong to the union. I talked to a woman one night in a hotel who came from a hotel in a private house and said that, you know, these are the advantages. And she was so frightened that she would lose her job. So I explained how certification went. I would tell no one that she'd belonged to the union, and she didn't have to tell anyone. And at that point in time, I sort of said to her, like, "What kind of money are you making?" And she said, "Well, I'm not getting paid. They're teaching me the job." On this basis, she had, you know, she wouldn't have counted because she would not show on a payroll. She didn't understand that. But she was so afraid of losing a job for which she wasn't being paid that she would not sign an application card.
What kind of pressure would supervisory personnel put on to people? Would they mostly threaten that they'd lose their jobs? Or?
I can remember an instance in a hotel where there were a lot of people who had come from Portugal. And these people were told, people who could not speak English were told by the person who could speak English, not the management. I mean, management doesn't do that very often. This case, he had them say, you know, if you join the union, you will have to pay for everything, including even a glass of water, and there's a good possibility you might be deported. Now, the only way I got this information was by one of our members, a maid who was doing translation for me. I actually could not have got anyone to come out publicly and say this was a threat. I don't know if the people were here illegally or not, but just the fact that they were told they might be deported, or the fact that they were told they were going to have to pay for these things, that all things would change, you know, the union would bring in these things. And if you try and get around to people in their homes, sometimes they're very frightened. Even if, you know, if it's a woman talking to a woman, they still are very, very frightened. They won't risk their jobs. They'll do anything rather than be forced into it. Even when husbands were saying to wives, "You should join, it's a good thing." Wives, I had one man who said, "Well, I'll sign the card for her." And I had to explain, "No, that isn't the way it works. She must sign her own card." And she would not sign her own card.
Did you ever hypothesize a bit about why there was that kind of fear of unionism amongst women, or maybe lack of knowledge about unions?
Well, it doesn't. I have to think carefully about that. Because you look at bartenders where there is nearly 100%, everybody just believed automatically that if a new hotel opened up and it had a beer parlor, then everybody will be union. And I think throughout the states this is what happened. Once you get past a certain mark that it is usual for people to belong to a union, then the others will go along with it. With the hotel and restaurant industry, which was such a transient industry, then people would say, well, why should I join a union? Because I don't tend to be doing this very long. Many of them, this is what they would feel. Or why should I join a union and take a chance of losing my job because I need the money for this particular thing? It could be at that time. And like, I have been out of it for 15 years, but I can remember, you know, meeting someone on the street and her saying to me, do you remember, you know, 15 years ago you asking me to join the union? And guess what? You know, I kept saying that I'm only going to be there a short time and I'm still there today. A lot of the women who take what they believe is part-time work and it becomes a lifetime commitment don't realize when they start out that if they joined a union, you know, that they could better their conditions. They're not going to be there. They didn't, at least, right. Used to believe that they were going to be there for a period of time.
Did you find that after the Second World War, at least a component of your workforce were women who had been in war industries or had had some experience with trade unionism, that would affect their desire to join a union?
No, because I believe that some women who worked during the war had to really fight to get full union status. Think of the street railway, where at first they didn't want the women who were operating the streetcars to have full union membership. So that some of them have gone, you know, through that way, so they weren't too knowledgeable. Another thing an argument that I found presented on a number of occasions were women whose husbands belonged to unions and who used this as a reason of getting out of the house and going having a few beers with the boys. Women said, well, all that happens at union meetings is that you argue and then everybody goes out and drinks beer. I don't want to be involved in that. I have a house to look after, children to look after. I can't take time to go to union.
So in that instance, the kind of responsibilities women had outside of the workplace affected their ability to participate?
I'm very sure of that. I would say my own experience, because I didn't have children and because my husband worked out of town a fair part of the time, actually worked towards my being advanced. If I had wanted to be an officer of the BC Fed, or whatever we called it in that days, there was no question. I could have run and been elected. In fact, I was immediately put on committees. The first conference I went to, I was put on the credentials committee. At the Trades and Labor Council, I was put on a committee where there were probably men who had belonged for a much longer period of time myself and not been recognized, but they were anxious to show that they did believe in women's rights. So I was given a bonus position because I was a woman.
Was that because women in the trade union movement at that time were raising the issues of women's rights?
No, they weren't doing it. It wasn't being done. It was the men themselves felt. And, you know, it was pointed out to me by people that were there in office that we are anxious to bring women in. We want to have them visible so that more women will realize that they should join the union. And actually the papers abetted to a point where they would go through and pick up the few women who were working as business agents. And I think there were maybe four around that time. And they, you know, had write-ups in the papers and our pictures and some write-up about us, letting people know that, you know, that women are not only trade union members, but that they were operating either as business agents or presidents.
What kind of other measures did the unions take to try and activate women?
I don't think they were taking any specific attitude towards women. Certainly in the beginning, it was just a question that more than 50% of your staff in a hotel would probably be female.
Mm-hmm. Right. Were there any specific kinds of contract demands that came out in the union?
Money. We were at such a low level, what we were looking at was money.
Did you ever oppose that in terms of women's right to make equal wages with men or relatively equal wages?
Only to this point, and that it happened while I was still working for the union, was that when a hotel specifically decides to cut back in staff, which usually would happen in those days because there weren't that many conferences, from September on, there was a cutback. So the area they would cut back would be where they could. The waitresses and maids would be sent home early. Because, again, men felt, well, what we should do is guarantee them so many hours. But because women had other responsibilities, that maybe they had to be at home to make sure the fires were going, they themselves broke what the union was writing up. A hotel was supposed to guarantee them 6 hours, they wouldn't take it. The restaurants had the same type of agreements that said, if you worked a short shift, you should get bonus pay. Mm-hmm. The employer actually wanted them to work full shifts, and the women didn't want to work full shifts. And their argument was, why should we pay people to work 4 hours when actually we've got 8 hours work? So while the bartenders union was getting extra pay because the men wanted full-time work, the women actually only wanted part-time work, and they weren't worrying about the few cents per hour because their other responsibilities were there and they would rather be home.
Did issues like